Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Dukmasova, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time on the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it's Friday, March 15th, 2024. Before I take the deep dive with my distinguished guests on something that has absolutely nothing to do with this news story, every now and then I just read this stuff, folks, and I have to laugh at how clueless we are as a civilization, particularly here in the city of Chicago. But I think in this case, Chicago is emblematic of everybody everywhere in the United States. So here's a headline in the Sun-Times. I'm not picking on the Sun-Times. This is a constant headline over the last 3 years in all the mainstream news. Every newspaper, every outlet. Census shows Cook County's population dropped in 2023, but the exodus is slowing. So the point of the headline, the point of the article is that increases in population are good. They show a sign of healthiness in an area. Republicans have used this as a weapon against Democrats for the last, 8 years. Somehow or other, the exodus of people from Chicago and Cook County in Illinois is a sign of Democratic incompetence or ineptitude or corruption or what have you. Of course, you can't believe anything a Republican says anymore. They are the most dishonest party they are currently the most dishonest party in America right now. And this current group of Republicans may be the most dishonest politicians of all time. That would be a great conversation with my distinguished guests, but we're not going to have that one. Is this the most dishonest group of Republicans ever? Wow, that's a good thought, distinguished guests. My point is, we have an opportunity to reverse this tide. It's called migrants flowing to Chicago, but somehow or other, the same media outlets that we'll write an article one day or do a news story one day about how we're losing population. We'll turn around the next day and go, there's a migrant crisis in Chicago. Look out. Too many migrants. Send them back. Kick them out of shelters. We are a weird, twisted society, ladies and gentlemen. Very weird, very twisted. All right. Without further ado, I'm going to ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself before I go down a road of madness on this subject. Distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Hello, I am distinguished guest Mick Dumke. I'm an investigations editor at Block Club Chicago and a friend of Ben's and a friend of the show's. And I am really glad to be here, Ben.
Yes, and we're not going to discuss immigration. I just saw that headline right before we started, and I was just shaking my head. This town is so weird, very weird town. Although, again, make a point out in the article, they talk about how great things are in Texas. So many people are moving in. I'm like, Texas, meanwhile, is leading the charge at slamming the door on immigration. Utter madness everywhere.
Well, you know, I was just in Texas last weekend. I was in the Houston area for the wedding of a family friend of my wife's and your frequent guest, Ramana's. And, you know, it's interesting because while Texas is still very red as a whole, the cities in Texas and a lot of the areas that are growing are actually led by Democrats, including, you know, the city of Houston, the city of Dallas, Austin. And I realize some of the growth is in suburban areas. Maybe they vote Republican, but Ben, this stuff isn't as simple as these narratives that you're harping on would lead us to believe, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, by the way, let's see how attentive Mick is. He's just in Houston. For 10 trivia points, Mick Dumke, what county is Houston in?
Is it Montgomery? We're in Montgomery County, which may be right outside, which was right outside of Houston. So the city of Houston may be in a different county. I will reveal my geographic ignorance here.
It's all right. So, don't worry. The only reason I know that is I just got finished reading this sometimes article. So it's really unfair. Harris County is the name.
Harris. There you go. That's yeah, right. Harris That's County. Right.
Yeah. No, it's very complicated. It's actually, there's a lot of factors at play in all of this. And what all my only lament, Mick, or no, it's not my only lament, but my particular lament at this moment is that at any given time, we will focus on one element without seeing how it connects to everything else. And I realize I have a tendency to pick on Chicagoans because they do this. And I understand Chicagoans have complained to me, Mick, you're so unfair to us. We're better than this, that it's like a larger than Chicago thing. You know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like to complain about migrants at the same time we're complaining about people leaving Chicago. We're complaining about people moving to Chicago. We're complaining about people leaving Chicago. We're just, you can't please us, Mick. We're very weird. That's,
yeah. Well, that sums up American politics in 2024, right? So all over the place.
All right, let's get to the main point and go back in time and then tie everything together. So Mick Dumke, ladies and gentlemen, yes, he is in charge of investigations at Black Globe. He's also a writer. And Mick just wrote a story for Black Globe that as Chicago's foremost authority on the works of Mick Dumke, I would put it in his top five. And I absolutely urge everybody out there to go track down Mick Dumke's latest story. It's, investigation. It is investigation, but it's not investigation the way that we think of investigation in Chicago. In Chicago, we think of investigation as something, a deep dive into a very current issue that exposes some kind of conflict or corruption. That's generally our take on investigation, waste of money. This story is really a story that kind of leads us to understand how we got to where we are as a city in many ways. And Mick tells it through a personal story of a man named Fred Mitchell, who is largely unknown to most people, but sort of was like a Forrest Gump character. Mick, he was like a witness in key moments in Chicago's history. He died recently at the age of 93. And I just think you did an outstanding job of bringing Fred Mitchell's story to life and in your own way of sort of explaining how it's relevant to Chicago history right now, where we are right now, politically speaking, both in terms of the rise and the fall, politically speaking, of the Black community's political power, the demographic changes in the city of Chicago, the resistance to integration, the influences of the Daily Machine, how the Daily Machine, Richard J. Daley, Old Man Daley, shaped where we are right now, politically speaking, our mindset politically, all these things. I can't urge people enough to go back and track down Mick's story about Fred Mitchell. It's in Black Club. So now that I'm done with those overall general kudos, Mick, why don't you take the deep dive point by point? So first of all, just explain to people who Fred Mitchell is or was, and then how you came to know him. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for spending time with the story, Ben, and for having me on to talk about it and for all your kind words. I really appreciate it. You know, this story meant a lot to me just because I had an all too brief acquaintance with this gentleman, Fred Mitchell. And as you've described, I thought he was so interesting. I thought his life story, once I got to know more about it, it was exactly what you said. I thought that he was just present for so many moments that were important in Chicago and even national history over the last 60, 70 years. And I got to know him briefly. So, let's answer your questions. Fred Mitchell was, among other things, a former precinct captain on the west side of Chicago in the early to mid 60s. He also was a city employee for a time. After that, he went into business with his father and owned a couple of grocery stores on the west side. I never was able to verify this, but I suspect he had to be one of the first or one of the few black grocery store owners in the 1960s and 1970s. It just didn't happen that much. And, you know, then worked for the federal government as part of the Veterans Administration, you know, until he retired in the early 90s. And after that, continued on as a neighborhood activist, leader of his local block club, involved in community policing initiatives, the CAPS program, as sort of a political gadfly at large, you know, like trying to educate his kids, his grandkids, his friends, engage them in political conversations, you know, railing against the Trump era well into his 80s and 90s. Just an extraordinary person. And I learned, unfortunately, last fall that just a few days short of his 94th birthday, he had passed away. I saw this on Facebook, which is relevant because Fred was very active on Facebook into his 90s. That was a way he stayed in touch with a lot of family, friends, even people like myself. Every time I go to a ball game with my wife, Romana, and Romana would post a picture of us at Wrigley Field, Fred would comment, "Looking good, Mick," or something about the Cubs. Just that kind of guy, just super friendly and eager to engage. So I was really, you know, saddened to see that he passed away last fall. And I went to his funeral at the time and met some of his kids and other family members, introduced myself. And, you know, from that point onward, I just thought I needed to find some way to pay tribute to this person. Not conventionally famous, but someone who was just so important in his own way, illustrating really like the importance of many people of his generation, but even in his own individual life, his own individual story arc, I just thought was so interesting and important that I wanted to take some small step to try to make sure he wasn't forgotten.
Again, I can't urge folks enough to read the article. He's just a classic one of what the late Harry Porterfield used to say on TV. Someone you should know, Fred Mitchell. All right. So Fred Mitchell was born in Mississippi, worked in cotton fields as a kid and moved to Chicago with his family, part of the Great Migration from the South to the North, and moved and settled here in Chicago. I want to say my memory is separate, sometime in the 30s. I think it was the 30s, Mick, or maybe it was the early 40s.
Yeah, 30s. He came up 30. In the 30s.
And this is the part of the story I'd like to get you to riff on a little bit about this early history. His family moved to the near north side. And they lived on the 300 block of West Oak Street in Chicago. And he went to Wells High School, graduated from Wells High School in 1947, I want to say. So, ladies and gentlemen, just think about this. This area right now is some of the most expensive real estate in the city. It is the Gold Coast. Just in terms of demographic changes, in the 1930s, it was a very much integrated neighborhood, working class neighborhood. This is before, obviously, gentrification completely transformed it. Wells High School was open the doors. Anybody who lives in a neighborhood comes to that school. Integration, Mick. Integration. Like, integration is doesn't really exist in Chicago. Maybe to a certain degree in the area where you live, in Rogers Park, yes. But by and large, integration is a foreign idea to the city of Chicago. And the Chicago's history, its legacy in real estate is segregation. And its history and legacy in schools is segregation. And one thing I really appreciate about Fred Mitchell's the view of the world, he was very aware of the significance of integration. He pointed that out to you, and you pointed it out in your story, that when he moved to the north side of Chicago with his family, it was an integrated neighborhood. It's so rare. That is such a rarity for the city of Chicago, at least now. Why don't you reflect a little bit about what that area was like back then, and the changes it's undergone and Fred's attitude toward it. Go ahead.
Well, you're absolutely right. This was something that was very important to Fred. He mentioned it to me when I interviewed him in 2019, and then he mentioned it to family members as well. His grandson, KJ Saffold, told me that his grandfather, Fred, had mentioned to him, you know, that he attended an integrated high school, that he played on integrated sports teams, like you said, in the 1940s, because if you didn't know anything about this history, you would assume, like you said, looking around even now, and certainly like if you have any awareness of the 60s, 70s, and 80s in Chicago, you would think that everything was segregated back then, and that we're on some sort of long, slow march toward integration. In fact, that is not the case. Fred was very proud of the fact that he participated in, you know, that he attended an integrated high school, participated in integrated sporting events, and he thought it was very important historically because, as his grandson noted to me, he saw it as an illustration of the fact that progress doesn't always move in a straight line, that sometimes we get to a point and then we backslide, you know, things hit obstacles, there are backlashes. And he saw his own life as an example of that. So like you said, moving up from Mississippi, at the time, the near north side had a large Italian community and a growing Black population, people moving up from the South because there were, you know, industrial sites in the area and there were jobs there. And the housing was cheap. I saw it in old news clippings repeatedly described as slum housing in the area. The particular building where Fred and his family first moved, 372 West Oak, it's no longer standing, by the way. There's a vacant lot there now. But I searched in old newspaper clippings for this address, and I found quite a number of references to it. And it appeared that amid this neighborhood and in the integration that it had, at least for a time, this was a building, it looked like, where a lot of Black people from the South ended up, just in terms of the way it was described in the references in these news clippings I found later. So I found that very interesting. And he had ended up there because some of his mother's side of his family had come to Chicago earlier than his immediate family did. And they were urging Fred's parents to come up here. There's more opportunities up here. You don't have to work as a sharecropper. You know, there are better opportunities. There's a potential for a better life for you and your kids up here. And so, as Fred's put it, he thought his father was one of the bravest people in the world because in the height of the Depression, he moved up here with six kids. They took the train up, got off at the train station at on Roosevelt and Michigan, and made their way to where they had family connections on the near north side. And that's where they settled for, you know, the next almost 20 years, decade plus for sure.
When I was reading about the Wells High School thing, I thought of a connection that, this just as an aside, in the same area, let me do this off the top of my head, Major Lance, Curtis Mayfield, and Jerry Butler. Three of our favorite singers. I would argue they're three of the greatest singers of the 60s. That's just my bias. I know you kind of feel the same way definitely about Curtis Mayfield. I just think of this area producing so much, there's so much talent in this area. You know what I'm saying? Makes so much, so many figures who were so important to the Jesse White is from this area as well. He went to Waller High School. He didn't go to Wells, but it's just, it's easy just to forget, just plow over the history of Chicago and just, you know, think of when the neighborhoods transform and we lose sight of what they once were and their significance and how much we've changed. And when I was just reading about Fred Mitchell and his family, just brought back these memories.
You're totally right. And if I can just jump in real quickly to add to that, those people you mentioned, not only did they grow up in the neighborhood, but they grew up at Cabrini Green, in the Cabrini Green complex specifically. And that was super interesting about Fred and his family history as well. They were among the first families to move into the Cabrini row houses when those opened in, they were built in like 1941, opened in 1942, somewhere right around there. And so, you know, they were among the first people, and they were built for, you know, to replace some of the substandard housing in the community, but they were built for working families at that time. And also, like, I think some people who are working in war industries and that sort of thing. So the images people later got of Cabrini Green, and you know, the whole history of Cabrini Green is a whole other tale, Ben, that we could spend multiple shows on. Yeah. But in those early days, it was really seen as a great opportunity and a step up from some of the other options that families had in this community. And that's the way Fred and his parents apparently saw it. And, you know, within a few years, they used that as a springboard to get their own home and to move over to the near west side. Yeah. So that's sort of the next phase of his story. I also realized that I forgot to answer an important part of one of your earlier questions, which was how I connected with Fred in the first place. I don't know if you want to talk about that now. Just pause the narrative for a second, because I think it's important.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. you read my mind, like a Gordon Lightfoot song. All right, obscure reference that nobody got. All right, so
if you could read my mind, I got it. Ben. I know, you know, maybe not as well as you, but I'm steeped in my 60s and 70s.
The connection. You met Fred through an article you wrote, which I would say is the number one article as the foremost authority on Mick Dumke articles. I would argue that it is the number one article. We did a show on it, which is a very popular show. I replay it from time to time just to introduce introduce it to a new audience, and it's about Ben Lewis. Mick Dumke's article about Ben Lewis, which you wrote, I think, ProPublica. I've lost track of who you wrote it for, Mick.
I was at ProPublica at that time. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. You can find it on the internet and you can listen to the show if you want to. And so it was Ben Lewis, legendary West Side alderman, first black alderman from the West Side. Mick, I cannot do justice to a synopsis of the Ben Lewis story, but you really can't understand Fred Mitchell's attitude toward politics. He entered politics roughly the time Ben Lewis was the elected alderman. So why don't you just as succinctly as you can tell the story of Ben Lewis and his significance? Go ahead.
Well, you started to tell the story. He was the first black alderman on the West Side during the era of what we know now or referred to now as, and was referred to then as plantation politics. These West Side wards were rapidly changing from predominantly ethnic white to predominantly black. But the politicians and the gangsters who controlled these wards did not want to cede their power. They did not do so willingly. And so what you had in a lot of the wards, including the ones that Fred Mitchell lived and worked in, namely the 22nd and 24th wards, you had these old white ward bosses who maintained a tight control over the politics and in some ways the business and development of these wards as well. And some of these ward bosses, Ben, did not even live in the communities, but they controlled them with a tight grip and only made sort of shows of sharing power with an empowering, black precinct workers, precinct captains, and that sort of thing. So in the case of Ben Lewis in the 24th ward, he was picked to be the alderman of the ward, but really the power still rested with some of the white politicians who continued to control it. And again, the white crime syndicate figures who continued to control that ward. About the time Ben Lewis started to speak up, he won re-election in February 1963, and like a day and a half later was found murdered in his ward office, and the crime remains unsolved. You're right. We did a deep dive on it on the show. People should definitely listen to that if they're interested. You can find my story. It's just an absolutely fascinating tale. Not because I wrote it. I'm just saying the mystery around this and all the politics, the organized crime, everything about it. It's just a crazy story. It really is.
Yeah, and it says so much about Chicago politics and the development of a black political muscle in this city and the resistance of the Daily Machine to fully integrating. So all like segregation is just a repeat. It's just a repeat theme in the history of Chicago, not just residential segregation, but political segregation. Fred Mitchell has a great metaphor, or explains the metaphor of plantation politics in your story. And why don't you take a moment to account that? Because again, this is a man, Fred Mitchell, who grew up or spent his early years in Mississippi on a plantation, working in the cotton fields. And so now we have the concept of plantation politics in the city of Chicago with the Daily Machine. So why don't you connect the two there, Mick?
Well, Fred did it the best. I was trying to find the quote real quick, but he said, look, I worked on a plantation as a kid. That's where I grew up. And on a plantation, there is one person in control. And everything, all your work essentially goes to that one, to benefit that one person. Any residuals, you might get a little piece of that. But there's one person in charge, and it's set up so that one person primarily can benefit. And he said the political system on the West Side, when he started working there, was just the same, that you had these bosses, and everything was about making sure they got elected, making sure the people that they were allied with got elected, and making sure that you performed, you got the votes out to such an extent that those ward bosses would get rewarded. Mayor Richard J. Daley, who was, of course, leading the city, but also just as importantly was the chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party, controlled dozens, hundreds of government jobs. And so those jobs would be doled out to the different wards and to the control of those ward bosses based on their performance at election time. So it really, as Fred described it, it really wasn't that different from having to bring in the crops and how that system was set up when you're working on a plantation in Mississippi. And so it's a metaphor, Ben. It's a saying that is somewhat un-PC, but when I talked about it with Fred and, listening again to my interview with Fred fairly recently, like he embraced the term because he thought it was so accurate.
It is accurate. I feel it's accurate beyond politics. Many times I feel I'm working on a plantation, Mick, and it has nothing to do with the Daily Machine. All right. An example of what Fred meant by plantation politics took place in 1964. And part of what makes plantation politics is the utter refusal to allow Black people a significant role in the Democratic Party or in the Democratic machine of Richard J. Daley until, like, you're forced by a court order, you're forced by overwhelming demographic changes, and even then you resist it. And this was on full display in many ways in 1964 in the case of the election of a congressman who was dead. And you and I once, I don't know if you remember this, Mick, spent about the better part of an hour discussing this. Wasn't even on the show, Mick. It was a Saturday.
Well, that's the thing, Ben, as your fans know, you are very similar on and off the mic. And our conversations that we record aren't very different from the phone calls we have. So just so everybody knows, this is 100% real. We did talk about this. I totally remember that because at the time, I think I just learned about this story and was poking into it a little bit. And you and I were kind of dissecting it and trying to figure out the significance and the meaning of it, because it's just it's another crazy story, you know, as you said, the story of segregation and disenfranchisement in Chicago.
All right. So tell it. Just go. The floor is yours. Thomas O'Brien. Go ahead.
All right. Well, quick background. So Fred, after coming back from, I won't tell the whole story, but Fred was seeking better opportunities. He was working a bunch of labor jobs. He had taken classes at like technical schools and community college to improve his skill set to try to, you know, get a decent job to support himself and his family. So one of the things he did, as they did back then, was he went to see his alderman, who at the time he was living in the 22nd ward, right next to the 24th ward in the Lawndale area. And his alderman was a guy by the name of Otto Janicek. I think I'm saying that right. But if you know better, Ben, please correct me. Long story short, through that conversation, Fred ended up getting an opportunity to work a precinct. He helped get the vote out for the Democratic Party and its slated candidates. And the part he really liked was he got to work with his neighbors to try to find out what their problems were, what needs they had, and to try to deliver some of those services to them in return for their votes. That was just the way it worked. It was a back-scratching system back then. And Fred saw it as deeply flawed, but that was the best opportunity for him to help his neighbors and the best opportunity he saw to get, chance at a better job. So eventually, in addition to his precinct work, he got a job as a court bailiff in what was known as the municipal court at the time. So by 1964, he had seen a lot working in the precincts. The congressman who represented most of the West Side at that time, there have been remaps since, but so that the districts were a little bit different, but the guy who represented most of the West Side was named Thomas O'Brien. And this is a classic Chicago political character, Ben. He's since largely forgotten to history. He's not somebody that people mention, certainly not in the same breath as somebody like Richard Daley. And I'm not suggesting he's on that level, but Thomas O'Brien was around for decades. At one point in time, he was the Cook County Sheriff. And then he served two different stints in Congress. And by the time he was on his second stint in 1964, he was in his 80s and was one of the longest tenured senior most members of the House of Representatives. So he had a lot of clout. I read a bunch of old news clippings about Thomas O'Brien, and you know, there were things like at one point in time, the military had some kind of facility in the Chicago area. I think it was like a medical facility, and they were going to move it somewhere to the east because that would have been better for them logistically. And Thomas O'Brien stopped it. He had the clout to cut a deal, sort of like, I think people who followed it more recently, I don't know who's in this realm, Dan Rostenkowski, Ben. I don't know if we have anybody in the current, no disrespect, but I don't know if we have anybody in the current congressional delegation with this kind of clout. So Thomas O'Brien was somebody who could get things done. And of course, he was a longtime loyalist to the Democratic Party and at this era to the Daily Run machine. However, he had been ailing for some time. He had a stroke, then he had a heart attack. I may be getting the order of those wrong, but he had a series of major health problems in quick succession. And he was hospitalized in Bethesda, Maryland, it looks like from the records I found, for weeks. So well before election day, primary election day, he was ailing, not in good health, not seen in the district. There were people murmuring about whether he could continue. Yet he remained the party's candidate. Fast forward to election day itself, primary election day, April 1964. At about 12:30, just after noon, Chicago time, Thomas O'Brien died. I don't know when the word got back to Chicago on this, but what was clear is that obviously at some point in the day, someone made a phone call that the congressman was dead. However, the machine did what the machine did. It just carried on. He coasted to reelection, even though he had died many hours earlier. And the news back then, it's not like today where you just get news alerts. It's the internet just reminding people. Back then, aside from word of mouth, you had to wait till at least the next day and sometimes 2 days later before news like this showed up in the papers. So the public didn't know about this in any kind of way, you know, widespread fashion for at least a day and maybe a couple days. By then, he had already been reelected. And of course, that kept control of the seat in the Democratic Party's hands. Not that that was really in doubt, but it's just one of those things that shows you how powerful they were and how oblivious they were to the voters and to the desires or needs of the voters at that time.
Yeah. And so after they finally owned up to the fact that the man they had just led to victory was in fact dead, they replaced him with someone who was not, to put it mildly, from the black community, a guy named Ronan. And so that in that way, they continued the plantation politics. And, you know, Mick, just pause for a moment and think about Richard J. Daley, the all-powerful Richard J. Daley. Had he wanted to, he could have just said to O'Brien back in 1963, right before the election, you know, Congressman O'Brien, what a great run you've had. It's time for you to move on. And we're going to take your choice of a black man from the West Side to replace you. And I would like you to endorse him and make the transition. What I'm saying is so naive. I realize saying it, but it's a concept of a city that believes and fosters integration. That is not that the politics aren't set up in a way to foster segregation, to keep white people on the top and black people below. If you get my point, Mick, I know it sounds naive just saying it, but a healthy political organization, in my opinion, would have had the leader, in this case, Richard J. Daley, do that. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a couple layers to that. So Thomas O'Brien often did not have an opponent. In this case, he actually did have an opponent, a woman named Bernetta Howell Barrett, who not only, you know, was involved in this case in running for office, but was a civil rights activist, a community leader, ended up later serving in the administration of Harold Washington, is still around and has been active, you know, into her old age, and just a widely respected figure. The public library had a traveling exhibit on Bernetta Howell Barrett's life last year. So again, there are clear lines from then till now. But your point is, so listen, if there was a truly progressive political environment, here is someone who is a leader of her community, who has stood up for her community, you know, involved in trying to make her community better and empowering her community, an obvious choice to replace Thomas O'Brien, either before or after he actually died and got reelected. That was not where Daley went. When Daley and the other ward bosses on the West Side finally realized that they were going to need to put a Black person in that seat, they picked someone who was a well-liked, but also well-known as a go-along-to-get-along type of guy named George Collins. I've interviewed a bunch of people who knew Alderman Collins. He was the replacement for Ben Lewis. And then a few years later, he was picked as the first West Side, first Black congressperson on the West Side. People who knew George Collins, including the current congressman for the West Side, Danny Davis, said nobody had anything bad to say about him as a person. He was always, somebody you would want to have a drink with. He was the life of the party. But he was picked specifically because he was part of the machine and that he wasn't going to shake things up. Fred Mitchell said the same thing, having seen this from the ground up. He said, you know, he was picked because everybody knew he was going to go along. Let me get the exact quote. They brought him in because he would go along with the program. That's the way Fred Mitchell described it.
Just think about it. Had they, I know it's unthinkable. I realize this is like a fantasy world, but let's say Mayor Richard J. Daley had pressed upon Thomas O'Brien to step down and had asked and supported Howe Barrett to run. I mean, she would have been like a really, relevant, legitimate, credible congressperson from the West Side at the time of think about what followed, Nick. The assassination of Martin Luther King, the riots on the West Side, the murder of Fred Hampton. It's almost like it's all lined up, part and parcel of the same thing. Resist every step of the way, bringing Black people into the party, bringing Black people into positions of power in the party, listening to what your representatives on the Black community have to say and making adjustments, as opposed to putting people in power who will just do whatever you say.
That's right.
Regardless
Absolutely.
Of what people in the community say. It's just like, what a waste, a series of wasted opportunities by the most powerful leaders of Chicago to have meaningful change in the city. And we are shaped by it to this day, Mick. The decisions
Absolutely.
That Daley met are affecting us to this day. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry I didn't interrupt, but it's in addition to the string of horrific incidents that you listed, maybe the worst thing that happened over the long term was the disinvestment by the government and by private businesses in the West Side that followed the assassination of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Fred Hampton. What happened after that, and I did another story with a couple colleagues at ProPublica about this, was that the West Side, basically everybody started to pull out of the West Side. And, you know, there was the classic white flight, there was business flight that followed. But the thing that was really striking when we were doing that story a couple years ago was that the government pulled out of the West Side. There were stories in the 70s and 80s about how city services slowed down and then got worse and worse. And this is all related to the plantation politics system, Ben, because when there finally was slowly a transition, at least on the surface level, a lot of the Black politicians who were allowed to take charge of these communities, or at least hold the offices in charge of them, they didn't have the same clout as the white bosses before. They couldn't deliver the same services even if they wanted to. It was set up to fail. And so you had this kind of spiral that was started by this disenfranchisement that led to, a slow, steady, economic decline of a lot of these communities. And they haven't recovered from it since. Here and there, there've been hardworking people, development, investment, but by and large, the West Side has continued to suffer because of the politics and the corruption and the disenfranchisement that was in place during Fred Mitchell's era in the 1960s and 1970s.
And Fred Mitchell himself, and then this is from Mick's article, we didn't mention this, was a Korean, a veteran of the Korean War. So he served in the U.S. Army. He couldn't get a conventional bank loan to start his grocery store.
That's right.
Think about that, ladies and gentlemen. He could. This is a Korean War vet, a guy who has a good job with the county, a stable income, not going to get fired job with the county, and he can't get a conventional bank loan. I think that just, when I read that, Mick, it's just like, wow, it just underscores the impact of racism and segregation in our city and why we are where we are today.
No, you're right. And he opened the grocery store because the previous grocery store owner decided to go into the liquor business instead. And we don't necessarily have to fault that owner for making a decision that was good for him, but liquor was more profitable than selling food to people. That was the decision that was made. How many times over have we seen that same decision replicated in that same neighborhood and other neighborhoods like it over and over again? So yeah, Fred and his dad decided, okay, well, we'll go into the grocery business. There's an opportunity here. But you're right, they essentially had to negotiate a deal with a wholesale supplier so they could get started. And they did well at it for a number of years. They had a couple of small, as his family described it, ma and pa stores, and then they opened a supermarket called Mitchell's Grocerland at the Rockwell Gardens housing development over on West Jackson Street, West Jackson Boulevard, and operated that for the better part of a decade, which isn't too bad. And I don't know much about the grocery business, Ben. I'm try to do my job as a journalist. I won't pretend I understand that business, but that's not a terrible run for a business like that to be in for 10 years or so as an independent grocery store. So that in itself, again, this is a person who all these chapters of his life are so revealing about the city and the nation, during the era that he lived in.
And at one point in the 60s, he had an experience, or his family had an experience with police brutality. And it's very illustrative how Richard J. Daley dealt with that, I thought. And so I'll allow you to tell the story. When I read it, Mick, I was like, man, Richard J. Daley hit the son, Baby Daley, the one that all you guys know, who ran the city in the 90s and O's and probably still running it today if he just didn't get tired of it. Because come on, face it, Chicago. You are incapable of not electing a Daley when given the opportunity. But Baby Daley learned so much from Daddy Daley on how you deal with things in the most surface level way without really taking the deep dive into, confronting like racism in the city, if you know what I mean, just the most surface level. And actually, Rom learned a lesson or two on this one.
I was going to say, it sounded so familiar, hauntingly familiar. So very quickly, after when Fred went into the grocery business, he continued to stay active in politics. I found several clips from the Chicago Defender in the late 60s of Fred leading a neighborhood organization that was demanding better city services and more political empowerment for Black residents of the West Side, and demanding that the machine of which he'd once been a part as a precinct captain, trying to work from the inside to help his neighborhood. He was saying, listen, we're still stuck. And the precinct captains you have, the Black precinct captains, aren't getting any of the good patronage jobs. If we have a patronage system, at least it should benefit everybody who participates in it equally. And that was not the case. Once again, you know, the Black precinct workers were getting the short end of the stick, he said. So then his family is forced into a true struggle with the machine and the mayor. One night, his brother-in-law, who worked as a manager in Fred's grocery store, was apparently on his way home. He was pulled over in what we now know as the Eisenhower Expressway. And long story short, Ben, whatever happened, he ended up dead after his encounter with the police. They claimed that he tried to run away. They had to pursue him. His mother, which would be Fred Mitchell's mother-in-law, said she just absolutely didn't believe it. That was not in his character. He had never been in trouble with the law before. You know, he was a working person with a family at home, on his way home after getting paid, and there would be no reason he would be fleeing from the police. But she was, I just thought that was striking. She was incredibly brave and strong when you read the coverage that was in the Defender and the Sun-Times at the time. So she first got a lawyer and they commissioned an independent autopsy. This is a whole side note, but the whole way that death investigations were done back then was completely ridiculous. It was completely unscientific. The county coroner was an elected official. He was part of the Democratic slate. He was a politician. There was no way you were going to get a thorough independent investigation about a police-involved killing from someone who was part of the Democratic slate. So the coroner would hold these, would summon quote-unquote juries, and they would essentially vote on what happened rather than a scientific examination of the body and the circumstances of the death. It would basically be up for a vote. And so they quickly cleared the police of any kind of wrongdoing and said the whole thing was just an accident. She, with her attorney, the mother-in-law, Fred Mitchell's mother-in-law, commissioned an independent autopsy that found that her son's neck had been broken. Mm-hmm. And so there obviously was something just horrific had happened in this encounter. She went on to sue the police department and get a fairly modest settlement a couple years later. In the meantime, she was so angry and outraged by the, obviously devastated by the loss of her son, outraged by the lack of justice, that she wrote a letter to Mayor Richard J. Daley that the Sun-Times published. They published the whole letter in the newspaper. And I mean, let me find the quote because it is, you can't do it justice. She, despite all the power that the mayor had, she took it head on. She wrote, "We may not get justice, but I feel there are a few facts you should know since you and your police department are going to such great lengths to cover up the truth." This is Essie Jones, the mother of this victim. "I loved my son as much as you love your sons. Does it really matter to you, or are you a mayor only for the affluent and the white?" Wow. I don't know how many people would have the courage to say that to a mayor now, let alone to say it to Richard J. Daley with all the power that he had back at that time. I mean, as horrific as this story is and as far too familiar as it is, given what we've been through in recent years with trying to have conversations and make advances in police accountability, I just think the upside to this story, if there is one, is the courage of this woman and her family to stand up and demand justice for their loved one. I just think it's extraordinary, Ben.
Extraordinary. And then Daly's response.
Yeah.
Richard J. Daly's response. First of all, like the settlement, I guess. It was so classic Laquan McDonald, Mike. I just read it and I'm just like, oh my God.
No, it's the same assembly line of fake justice. It's very, very similar. The settlement came a little later, but you're right. So I kind of screwed up the chronology, but in the immediate aftermath of her letter, then the mayor, Mayor Daly, wrote her a letter, which of course was shared with the Sun-Times as well. And he essentially said, oh, I didn't know about all that. I didn't understand the circumstances of the incident. That's the word he used, circumstances. And then he said, I heartily agree with you that the most thorough investigation is called for. Well, that may have sounded pretty good, but the long and the short of it was, no thorough investigation was found. The police department was conducted, I should say. The police department's internal affairs division, which from that time on up into, well, maybe up until the current time, has had the reputation of burying the truth just as often or more often than it's actually investigated things thoroughly. So this, they supposedly did an investigation. They determined the officers had not used excessive force. I don't know how somebody ends up with a broken neck and there's no excessive force used, but that's what they determined. And then, as I said, the city eventually settled a federal lawsuit trying to make the whole thing go away by agreeing to pay $90,000 to the widow of the victim of this police killing.
Yeah, and when I read that thing about Daly not knowing about the matter until he read about it in the Sun-Times, I just thought I really flashed back to Rahm, his claim that he didn't know what was on the videotape.
Right.
yeah. God. Wow. What a city. Nothing's changed. So that happened in what, 1960? What year was it, Mick?
1970. It was 1970. Yeah.
Okay, and of course, the Rahm Emanuel burying of the Laquan McDonald tape was in 2015. So, you know, not much changed in those 45 years. All right, we'll close with this. You don't really go into it at great length, but I had a smile when I read this. At the age, in his late 80s and into his 90s, Fred Mitchell was still following politics. God, I wish I knew about him. I'd have brought him on as a guest, no doubt, because he would have been a great guest. But he was railing against Trump. And there's a lot of us in that same boat, Mick, railing against Trump. And his insights into the Trump MAGA movement, I thought were worth mentioning. Where he talked about the real dangers of the MAGA movement. It wasn't so much Donald Trump. It was the fact that 45% of the public, roughly, is ready to walk off a cliff for this guy. Yeah. So why don't you go into Deke? You probably had a few conversations with Mr. Mitchell about Donald Trump.
You know, I actually didn't. But what was striking was when I talked to family members and friends, several of them said the same thing. They said, because I was curious, well, what was his view of things in more modern times, like Trumpism? And they all said, oh, obviously he was not a fan. He was really upset about some of the things we're talking about with police accountability issues. He was upset about social inequality, both economic inequality, racial injustice. And he was upset about our, you know, slide away from democracy. But he told several family members and friends who related it to me that, you know, Trump, he didn't think was the real problem. Of course, they didn't like him. But like you said, the real problem was the people who fell for it, Trump's supporters, that they were willing to go along with this for their own convenient reasons. And that's what really upset and disturbed him. Not one man, but all the millions of people cheering this man on or watching him lead us down this dangerous road. And I agree with you. I thought that was really striking. And it said something about, of course, you know, Fred understood politics. He had worked in the belly of the beast, as you would say, Ben. Yeah. He understood power. He understood manipulation. And so he would tell his grandkids, don't fall for it. Don't fall for what they're saying. Try to figure out what they're really getting at. Why are they saying it? And they shared these kinds of stories with me. So I just thought that was really interesting and important to note. This person never stopped being a citizen his whole life.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. That's a good spot to end it. I'll repeat. I'll urge absolutely everyone, go read Mick's story, D-U-M-K-E. It's not going to be hard to find it, all right? No, I can't find it. I'm a Chicagoan. You just Google Dumpkey. You'll find it within a second or two. And y'all know how to get to the internet when you, I don't know, whatever you guys do on the internet. So go on the internet and read this tribute to Fred Mitchell, a very compelling story about Chicago's history, particularly the whole notion of plantation politics. Mick, we've run out of time, so I can't get into our favorite topic or one of our favorite topics, my beloved Chicago Bulls, now Mick's beloved Chicago Bulls. But I'm just going to tell you something, a little secret about Mick Dumpkey, ladies and gentlemen. And I told him this secret this morning when we talked. I'm going to share it with all of you. When the Bulls win, it's our Bulls. When the Bulls lose, Ben, what about your Bulls?
I baited you into that, and you went for it as predicted, which makes me very happy. I feel the losses as well. Probably not quite as much as you do, but I won't lie about that. But yeah, you know, when you're a fan, you get it. And speaking of fanatical insanity, the Big Ten tournament, it's tournament basketball time right now. Conference tournaments right now. So in addition to cheering on the Bulls and the ever fainter hope that they're going to move up in the playoff seedings, I am also like starting to get a little nervous. The Northwestern Wildcats men's team tips off in about 15 minutes against the Wisconsin Badgers. And I think they're going to make the NCAA tournament anyway, even if they lose. But boy, it would sure be nice to beat the Badgers and feel a little bit more comfort when you see the NCAA drawings on Sunday. So that's where my mind is, Ben. Basketball, basketball, basketball right now.
You know, and it's a good place to have your mind. Well, wait. So my memory is a little fuzzy. Northwestern's record against Wisconsin this year, 1-1, 1-0, or 2-0?
0-1, I believe. They've only played them once. Yeah, well, it's weird. They didn't play a home and away series. They only played at Wisconsin, and they lost a very close game. They lost basically in like the last minute and a half, but they did lose. Since then, the Wildcats are pretty beat up, and Wisconsin, I don't think, even has a 500 record over the last month or 5 weeks. So these are two teams that are really hungry to try to get a win before the NCAA tournament. So,
well, as I like to point out to you, in sports, a lot of times it's just the jersey. So I talk about this with the Bulls in Orlando. The Bulls see Orlando's jerseys and they fall apart.
Yeah.
And there's something about the Wisconsin jerseys that really afflicts Northwestern. I mean, it doesn't even matter who's wearing. You can put the jersey on Mick Dumpkey and the Northwestern will fall. We can't rebound. We can't do anything. It's the jersey. Sports is very weird.
Sports is weird. So hopefully by the time everybody, you know, hears this, the Wildcats will be continuing their march to a Big Ten conference
By the way, was Fred tournament title. Mitchell a sports fan?
He was. I didn't talk to him that much detail about kind of his fandom now, but, you know, he played football. He was a wrestler. I think he played baseball back in the day, as we were saying earlier, on these integrated teams that he was very proud of. So, great character. I wish I had more time with him, but hopefully if people are interested, they'll check out the story, Ben, because he should be remembered.
All right. Very good. That's Mick Dumpkey. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.